Okay, today my initial plan is to make today's lecture the last of these lectures. Although some few of you have actually spoken to me about in the past, so I might take the time to read it. But today, the main business is going to be talking about Aristotle, following on from Plato last week, and making a big historical leap from Aristotle to Sir Philip Sidney. There's some stuff on the board that's a combination of Latin and Greek terms, and these are terms that I might be using during the lecture. How are we doing for handouts? Clear? Got them? No? Okay, there's still a batch needed. How many do we need at the back? Stick your hand up if you haven't got a handout. Oh, a number. Okay.
Actually, can one of you do me a wee favour? Could you do me a wee favour? I should make you go to the back to distributors and you.
Thank you. Okay. First up then, Aristotle. As I think I mentioned to you last week, Aristotle was taught by Plato. Plato having been taught by Socrates. Aristotle was taught by Plato. And in his thought, in Aristotle's thought, the place of culture in political life was, exactly as in the thought of his teacher, Plato, of some central importance. How are you doing with those handouts? Just leave them and they'll distribute them themselves. Just send them back as well. Okay. You'll remember that Plato's major concern was pretty firmly ethical and political. But Aristotle, on the other hand, begins to assume that some of the ethical and political questions about the place of art in a culture have been answered, and they've been answered by his teacher. As we'll see, he thinks that his teacher gave some of the wrong answers, and he disagrees with Plato on a number of matters. But he turns attention instead, in his Poetics at least, his most famous text to do with literature, his Poetics, he turns to the more purely aesthetic considerations, to questions of the form of the work of art itself. In other words, if you go back to that diagram that I showed you way back when, 15, 20 weeks ago, where you had the work at the centre of the diagram, the author at the top, the reader, and the universe, remember those coordinates of Luther criticism, Aristotle turns his attention directly onto the form of the work of art itself in the Poetics. There are other texts by Aristotle in which he addresses questions of ethics, place in culture and so on, particularly the Nicomachean Ethics, but I'm not going to speak about that today. I'm going to speak just about the round about the Poetics. But if you think of this, you can think of Plato as someone who is concerned with all the stuff round about the work of art in itself, whereas Aristotle, as it were, reprioritizes the work of art as being of central interest. And his theory becomes what seems to be a rather formalist or aestheticizing theory. Plato had been led by his interest in the political dimension of the aesthetic to stress the necessity for finding knowledge as opposed to opinion, remember? Dialectic, as he called it, in the intelligible realm rather than illusion in the realm of the visible or the physical. That's all that stuff, remember, about the importance of the form. I use the example of the form of a bed, which is, as it were, a pure idea of bedness, something that I pointed out to you. Relates a little bit to that Saussurean concept of the signified, where the signified represents the kind of concept of something. So Plato, interested in dialectic, interested in knowledge. Aristotle also finds these things to be of major importance, but he casts all this in a rather different set of terms. And what he does, interestingly, is that he uses a set of terms and terminology that grants much importance to the realm of appearance. So horaton, as it's called in the Greek, what he's trying to do is to say that actually appearance, to horaton, is the medium that we have upon the intelligible, to noeton. In other words, whereas for Plato there's a big distinction between these two things, a big divide, for Aristotle you can use the realm of appearance to get to the realm of knowledge. For Plato there was, as it were, a division between these two things, not that they were opposites, but there was a division between them. Aristotle kind of accepts the fact that they're different, but says that we can get at the realm of the intelligible by looking at the realm of the visible. And that immediately grants a huge importance to the realm of the visible, to the realm of the work of art, the play, for example, that you're seeing in front of yourself in the first time. So this amounts, I think, to Aristotle saying that, unlike my teacher Plato, I'm going to pay much more attention to the work of art as it is in itself. And then I'm going to suggest how this formal entity operates in such a way as to direct our attention and our thought not just upon the work of art, but upon the intelligible to which the work of art will refer us, the intelligible realm. So for Aristotle, art is a means whereby we can bridge the gap between appearance and the intelligible, or the gap between belief and dialectic. Art can correct our opinions and can work to offer knowledge in place of opinion. It's very important to bear in mind here that the distinction that Aristotle is placing in front of us is not that hoary old distinction between appearance and reality. No, he's more interested in a slightly different formulation, the difference between appearance and intelligence. So it's not appearance and reality, appearance and intelligence. And what he's saying is that we can use appearances, the realm of appearances, the realm of work of art, works of art, representations, in order to get to intelligence, in order to get to the realm of the knowable. When Aristotle comes to make the Poetics essentially is a set of lectures that he gave. And his major concern in the Poetics is tragedy. He's giving a series of lectures on what constitutes tragedy and what makes a good tragic play. And in this text, Aristotle behaves rather like that kind of literary theorist that I described to you again a way back, I think, in the first couple of lectures, the literary theorist who, having read lots and lots of stuff, or having watched an awful lot of plays, then goes on to be able to abstract from the particular examples a kind of formulaic theory as to how the examples work. In other words, having read the way that I talked about it in the first couple of lectures, having read 100 crime novels, you can now tell me how to write a crime novel. Having read a million Mills and Boone romances, you can tell me how to write a Mills and Boone romance. And if you suspect for one moment that there's some kind of genius or mysterious way of writing those Mills and Boone romances, all you need to do is to contact the publishers and say that you'd like to write one, and they'll send you a sheet that tells you how to write one. Chapter 1, introduce the hero. Has to be a rugby player nowadays. Used to be an airline pilot or a doctor. Chapter 2, introduce the heroine. Heroine has to be a bit weak, preferably maybe a physiotherapist in the rugby club, or we used to call them air hostesses, and they probably still are still called that in the London Boone. In other words, you get a kind of formula for how you write the thing. So you write the thing according to the formula, send it off to the London Boone, and they'll write it back and tell you the corrections that you need to make in order to make the show another lot of money. That's a good thing. You'll be able to do that kind of thing. So I'm not suggesting that Aristotle had much to do with Mills and Boone romances or with the crime novels, but what I'm saying is he's the kind of theorist who says, now that I've watched 100 plays, I can tell you why they work and how they work and what ones are the best and which ones, therefore, need to be corrected. In the Poetics, then, what he does is to describe the workings of those tragedies that won the prizes at public performances. In his day, typically you would have a number of new plays being presented to the public in the Agora, and what happens is that the public essentially vote on them, and you get to find out which ones win the prizes. These are the best plays, because they are the ones that win the prizes. And they win the prizes because the public likes them. Now, Aristotle doesn't ask very much, at least in the Poetics, he doesn't ask very much about the kind of value judgments and the worth of the plays based on these value judgments that are being made by the people. He accepts that because the people are saying these are the ones that we think are the best, he accepts that these are the best tragedies. In the Poetics, at least. Elsewhere, he would call that into question. Given that these are the ones that win the public prizes, these are the ones that are meeting with public and political approval, and Aristotle's task is to explain to his pupils, therefore, the workings of the best tragedies, and that's what the Poetics is about. A mode of mimesis is crucial to Aristotelian aesthetic theory in all of this. Because representation and imitation are taken by Aristotle to be basic axiomatic principles of human being. The human is human because she or he is different from various other kinds of entity, including certain kinds of animals. Humans laugh, for example. Dogs, they sometimes look as if they're laughing, but in fact they're not. So Aristotle is able at one point to define the human as the animal that laughs, that's capable of laughter. And from that, you would imagine that he'd be interested in a theory of comedy. And indeed, apparently he was, but we don't have the text. On the back of the handout, you will see that Umberto Eco, in The Name of the Rose, tries at one point to formulate the text of what the poetics of comedy would have been. However, what he's saying here is that as well as being the animal that laughs, we are the animal that imitates. That's how we learn things. We learn things by imitation. You learn the language that you're currently speaking or thinking in by imitating the sounds that you heard round about you. And it's through imitation that we learn all things. Therefore, he says, mimesis, representation, is an educative tool. Mimesis or representation is something that we can use in order to learn things. Plato, remember, also thought something similar. And Plato's anxiety was that if you start imitating the wrong things, if you start imitating the guardians, but in a, or rather, let's suppose you are a guardian, and you start imitating roles that are inappropriate to being a guardian of the public, Plato's argument is that you eventually become that kind of thing. One way that I can describe that is you play the part of being in love with somebody, because you want something to happen with that somebody. It's Saturday night after all, and you know, you're a bit at a loss as to what to do, nothing much on the telly, so and here you are, there's somebody sitting next to you. I know what I'll do. I'll pretend I'm in love and let's see what happens. And you know what happens. And then, if you keep doing it, because actually it's quite a lot of fun and better than television, you begin to think, hang on a second, maybe I am in love. By imitating something insistently, you can get to the reality. Plato was aware of this, was anxious about it. Aristotle says essentially this is how we learn things. We learn things through an imitation. Importantly, he says that philosophy, he doesn't say this in the Poetics, is it elsewhere? Philosophy is eudaimonic, it cheers you up. For Aristotle, it was better and it made you happier to know something than to be in a condition of ignorance about it. So philosophy, he says, is fundamentally an exercise in cheering you up, eudaimonia, which means happy spirit, well-spirited. It's fundamentally what the word means. Philosophy, knowing things, cheers you up. And imitation is a very important part of this eudaimonia. We enjoy representing things. We enjoy imitating things. We enjoy learning by imitation, he argues. In fact, we can go so far as to enjoy the representation of things that may be horrid in themselves. So we can enjoy watching somebody gouge their eyes out on stage. We can enjoy going to see, much, much later, King Lear, in which Gloucester will get his eyes plucked out on stage in front of us. And while that would normally be the kind of thing that we would find rebarbative, when it operates in the realm of imitation and when we're learning from it, we can actually enjoy it. Not because we're sadistic, but because we are in a process of learning eudaimonically. The root of our pleasure lies in the knowledge that we gain from watching somebody's eyes being plucked out. And usually that's more than the simple knowledge that if somebody gets their eyes plucked out, they can't see very much. It's usually something much deeper than that in tragedy. So here then, representation is being given a different kind of status and indeed a greater importance than Plato seemed to give to it. The question immediately arises, what happens to truth in this Aristotelian prioritization of appearance? What happens to truth? Aristotle deals with Plato's concerns for truth in a rather neat philosophical gesture. He makes a distinction between poetry and history. And you have this on the handout. It's the first of the Aristotle passages in the handout. Chapter 9 of the Poetics, Poetic Truth and Historical Truth.
It'll be clear from what I have said that it's not the poet's function to describe what has actually happened, but the kind of things that might happen. That is, that could happen because they are, in the circumstances, either probable or necessary. The difference between the historian and the poet is not that the one writes in prose and the other in verse. The work of Herodotus might be put into verse, and in this metrical form, it would be no less a kind of history than it is without metre. The difference is that the one tells of what has happened, that's the historian, the other of the kind of things that might happen, the poet. For this reason, poetry is something more philosophical and more worthy of serious attention than history. For while poetry is concerned with universal truths, history treats of particular facts. So, history will give you, as it were, only the local. Poetry is much bigger than that, more philosophical than that, because it will take the local as a representation of something more general. So when you go and watch King Lear, you're not just watching Gloucester getting his eyes plucked out in its specificity. You're seeing the specifics of that in relation to the play, but you're also learning something about what Shakespeare felt about how you gain insight, which has to do with not paying so much attention to superficial appearances that you get with your eyes, and more getting a sensory feel from your other senses, and from that getting a sense of how rationally the world works. Crucially here, by universal truths, this is Aristotle again, by universal truths are to be understood the kinds of things a certain type of person will probably or necessarily say or do in a given situation. And this is the aim of poetry, although it gives individual names to its characters. So here, the key thing here is that this distinction between poetry and history is a difference between, on the one hand, what has happened, and on the other hand, what we think might happen, what ought to happen, what is probable. So truth, as some kind of mathematically verifiable knowledge, something can be documented as fact, gives place here to the primacy of truth as something that is governed by probability and indeed by what he will call in the Greek ananke, or necessity. Ananke. You would write it like this. A-N-K-E. It just means necessity.
Sometimes translated as fate. Aristotle is arguing that because poetry deals with what he calls these universals rather than particular truths, which is the material of history, then poetry becomes more philosophical than history, and because of that, it gives us a greater access to the intelligible realm. In other words, we will look at the appearance of something on stage, and from that we will get to the realm of knowledge, because it is giving us access to something that's general, generalizable. We could make a distinction here, which is a simplistic distinction, which would suggest that Socrates, and after Socrates, Plato, begin to identify the truth as that which has happened, that which really is the case. And that gives you a sense that truth was in the past. And our task now is to live up to that truth. For Aristotle, truth certainly was in the past, but at the same time, for Aristotle, there's an important sense in which we will look forward to project or invent a new truth from the appearances that are in front of us. So Aristotle sees the value of poetry lying in its ability to predict future behaviour, not just its ability to represent what has happened actually. Aristotle sees the value of poetry as lying in its ability, among many other things, its ability to predict the future. So poetry, then, is illusion, accepted as such, but no less valuable for that. For Aristotle, the credibility of the illusion is the most important thing. If the illusion is credible enough, it will have a philosophical implication that is valid. And in that way, the illusion implies something in the way of knowledge. Maybe not yet in the way of truth, but in the way of knowledge. You could see this as a way of moving away from a demand for truth to a demand for knowledge. This credibility, in turn, lies in the organisation of the poet's materials or the plot of a tragedy. Above all else, says Aristotle, tragedy is the imitation of an action, and plot thus becomes much more central than character to an analysis of how a tragedy works. While we spend much of our time interested in the characters of tragedy, go this evening and watch Othello, you'll be interested in Patrice Nyamana playing Othello as a character, and that's very, very important for us. But for Aristotle, as indeed maybe when you go and see Othello this evening, or at some point during his run, for Aristotle, that is subservient to the plot. The organisation of material, the organisation of events, gives you the realm of the necessary and the probable, and that shapes the analysis of how tragedy works. The poet, he says, is primarily a maker of plots, not a maker of verses. Because medical, legal, historical documents and so on can be written in verse. So the poet distinguishes herself by being a maker of plots. The plot must be coherently organised, and although it can be complex, it must be oriented in one direction. It must have one central trajectory. It must also be recognisable as an organisation of events that is probable or necessary. So you're unlikely to be writing a tragedy in which, for example, there's a man and a woman having a major argument at home, and there's a young child watching the man and the woman having a major argument at home, and the young child doesn't know who to side with. And at that moment, an alien spaceship lands in the garden. That's not really what it says. But you know that kind of thing that young people write when they write their first short stories? You may even have one in your back pocket, even as I speak, in which aliens are landing right now, like a kind of deus ex machina to sort things out. That's not really likely to happen. It's not going to get a very good plot. A much better plot, says Aristotle, is where the child intervenes and says, "But Daddy, you said yesterday." And the father knocks the child about the head. And the mother says, "Don't you dare do that to my child." And the father says, "But it's my child as well." And the mother says, "That's what you thought." At that moment, says Aristotle, that is likely to happen, given the circumstances in which we find it. It's much more likely than having aliens landing, okay? So in the plot then, you've got something which might be complex, but must be recognisable as an organisation of events that is probable or necessary. While Plato saw imitation as an imitation grounded in things as they are, Aristotle attends instead to things as they appear to be. And he likes the realm of appearances. But he likes the realm of appearances because appearance is useful, and it's useful to Aristotle and to his theory, only insofar as it implies a knowledge that is lurking behind the appearance. So for Aristotle, the important thing here is that we infer knowledge from appearance or from the imitation of knowledge. And the function of criticism is to infer knowledge from appearances. Not to infer opinion from appearances, like Plato. Aristotle too, was concerned with knowledge above opinion. But the function of criticism is to infer a knowledge that you can get from the realm of appearances. Accordingly, the material of a tragedy must be manageable. And according to Aristotle, if this desired effect whereby the audience gains access to knowledge is to come about, the writer of a tragedy must manage her or his materials in such a way that a process of cognition and then recognition can come about. To this end, there must be an apparent or implicit logic, a necessity to the action, and even though the plot will be complex in the best work, it will be unified in the sense that it will have a clear orientation. Now, a little aside here. Some people think that Aristotle, some people have taught that in truism, Aristotle prioritised the unity of plot, the unity of character, the unity of place. The three unities that govern a good tragedy. And from that, we begin to think that unity shapes good value in things. So we find ourselves talking not just about the unity of plot in a tragedy, but we talk about the unity of a novel, or the unity of a poem, the way that a poem hangs together as a coherent, internally informed logic that is unified. And you find yourself in the ridiculous position sometimes of reading things like Ezra Pound's Cantos, or T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, a poem that's spectacularly falling apart at the edges, and arguing that although it looks as if it's falling apart, actually it's unified, because you feel somehow that unity is an important value in and of itself. Well, Aristotle didn't have any particular view on this. This idea of the unities emerged in the 1570s by and they come in an edition of the Poetics translated by Ludovico Castelvetro. Castelvetro, all one word, Castelvetro, in his 1570 edition of the Poetics, he was the first to suggest that Aristotle had prescribed a rule of unity. But what Aristotle argues about the plot is that the plot should be of the correct scope, neither too all-embracing nor too tiny, and it must be economically organised, with no superfluity and no lack of necessary detail. That's all he says about it. That it must be the right size for this length of play. And the length of this play is typically 2 hours or so. So you can't write the history of the world in 2 hours. It's a wee bit like you writing an essay. Suppose you've got an essay that's 1,500 words long. Okay, you've got to write an essay 1,500 words. And your title is the Meaning of Joyce, Wolfe, Lawrence, Thomas Mann, in the light of their engagement with the Bible and the Quran. Well, your title is going to take up nearly 1,500 words. You're not going to have very much room to argue something very well in 1,500 words. Likewise, if you say the title here is the importance of the word and in the first sentence of Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, then likewise, it's going to be a wee bit of a stretch to get that up to 1,500 words. In other words, what you're looking for is something that is economically organised, tight, as it were. Aristotle's saying the same thing about the tragedy. So Aristotle argues that tragedies quite often limit themselves to what he calls a single revolution of the sun in chapter 5 of the Poetics. But he acknowledges there that they may, and sometimes do, exceed the 24 hours in question. The unity of a plot means for Aristotle the singularity of an action rather than a diversity of interest, which might decenter our attention. In other words, it means focus. At no point is anything mentioned in the Poetics about the unity of place. So while I'm about the business of dismissing some illusions, let me dismiss another illusion. Some people think that Aristotle is the root of something that we call the tragic flaw. You maybe heard this in the way in which you write about tragedies. Macbeth is a great guy, but he has a tragic flaw. Something in his character, you know, like an overweening ambition in Macbeth's case, or paying too much attention to his wife, that nasty piece of work, Lady Macbeth, flaw in his character. Or King Lear is a great guy, but he hath ever slenderly known himself. Has either Goner or Regan, I've forgotten which now, put it. So he lacks a bit of self-knowledge. Othello's a fantastic guy, it's just that he's a wee bit prone to sexual jealousy, and that's his tragic flaw. And that explains somehow the tragedy. Well, all of this comes from a psychoanalytic reading of the word hamartia in Aristotle. We would write it like this in our alphabet, hamartia. Hamartia is a flaw or an error, and Aristotle uses it, and he says often, and at one key point I'll show you in a moment, that sometimes characters have this hamartia. Hamartia is a term taken from the discourse of archery, and it means missing the mark.
means when you pull the barrel back and fire and miss the target, everybody standing around goes, oh, that's a hamartia, you missed the mark. Okay? That's what it means. It's something which goes in the wrong direction and misses its target. I think I've given you a bit of this, have I not? No, maybe I haven't on the handout. Oh no, I have. If you look at the tragic action passage on the handout, what Aristotle is talking about, the kind of man who is not conspicuous for virtue and justice, and whose fall into misery is not due to vice and depravity. Okay, so tragedies involve somebody having a fall, a catastrophe, a downwards turning. Kata meaning downwards, strophe meaning turning, a catastrophe. And sometimes that happens to the kind of man who is not conspicuous for virtue and justice, but whose fall into misery is also not due to vice and depravity. In other words, it's not your own fault. But their fall is due rather to some error. That's the hamartia, some missing of the mark. A man who enjoys prosperity and high reputation, like Oedipus and Thyestes and other famous members of families like theirs. That error there has been translated in the 20th century, and therefore for us in the elders of the 21st century, has something to do with a psychoanalytic flaw, a flaw of character. Okay, that's enough on Aristotle for the moment. Let me turn to Sir Philip Sidney. I'm turning to Philip Sidney because the classics were rediscovered in the Renaissance, among them Aristotle. And Sidney picks up on many ideas from Plato, Aristotle, and Horace, whose name's at the bottom of the board here, from his Ars Poetica, The Art of Poetry. Here are some things that Sidney picks up that you'll immediately recognise, and if you've been reading The Apology for Poetry by Sidney, you'll have seen some of this already. Sidney distinguishes poetry from philosophy. Likewise, he distinguishes poetry from history. Thirdly, he suggests that poetry produces knowledge. And poetry, we could say, therefore, is epistemological in some sense. It produces knowledge. Fourthly, poetry basically is an art of representation. It's representational. And fifthly, above all, poetry is great fun. It's pleasurable. It gives you, and he's getting this from Horace, it gives you a sweet learning. It's useful as well as being sweet. You know this as the utile dulce, useful and sweet, pleasant. Okay, so poetry is both useful and pleasant, but above all, it's pleasurable. I'm going to try to organise this for you in a couple of parts in relation to Philip Sidney, and we'll come back to the handout on Sidney in a moment or two to do this. Let's talk, first of all, about representation. Like Aristotle and Plato, Sidney argues for a basically representational mode of poetry. That's to say, poetry is, as it were, derivative upon something else, the something else being seen as being more foundational, more real in some kind of way. But while Plato argued that the ground for poetry was the idea, or the ideal, the realm of ideals, and while Aristotle claimed that the ground was the realm of appearances, or you might call it now phenomenology, Sir Philip Sidney makes a quite extraordinary claim that I've given you on the handout. The claim here is that poetry improves upon nature. If you look at the handout, the first bit from the Apology, Nature never set forth the earth in so rich tapestry as diverse poets have done, neither with pleasant rivers, fruitful trees, sweet-smelling flowers, nor whatsoever else may make the too much loved earth more lovely. Her world is brazen, the poets only deliver a golden. But let those things alone and go to man, for whom as the other things are, so it seemeth in him her uttermost cunning is employed, and know whether she hath brought forth so true a lover as Theagenes, so constant a friend as Pylades, so valiant a man as Orlando, so right a prince as Xenophon Cyrus, so excellent a man every way as Virgil's Aeneas. Neither let this be jestingly conceived, because the works of the one be essential, the other an imitation or fiction.
For any understanding knoweth the skill of the artificer, standeth in that idea or foreconceit of the work, and not in the work itself. Okay. So, nature gives us a great world, especially if you're rich. It's a little aside. The Marxist in me comes out. Okay. Nature gives us a really great world. It's full of lovely snow, you can go out and enjoy it, and so on. However, is it anything like as good as the world you get in poetry? No. Poetry gives you something much better than nature can do. And it does this in a way that is useful as well as being sweet. That's an extraordinary claim. And what follows from it is that representations that we get in poetry must be misrepresentations. Because if the poetry represents the world as it is, it's going to give us a brazen world. It must therefore misrepresent the world. And it would follow from this that we get a knowledge not because poetry reflects the world as it is, not because it gives us access to some kind of truth that's not immediately there in the realm of ideas, but because it misrepresents things. And that's quite an extraordinary claim. It's a bit like saying, in an ethical sense, we can get the truth by telling a lot of lies. And that's also quite an extraordinary claim. But if you think about it, it shapes a great deal of what we do as literature and cultural critics when we're confronted with hard scientists. Hard scientists will tell us truths about the world as it actually is. And those are quite hard to bear sometimes. The truth that when you drop a bit of sodium into water, there's going to be an explosion. And if you get a certain kind of nuclear fusion, there'll be a big explosion. These are truths universally acknowledged. But they're different from the truth universally acknowledged that you get at the beginning of Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice. And that universally acknowledged truth, we claim, is something more fundamental than just being able to describe why it is the case that when you drop the sodium into the water, there will be this reaction and this explosion. We say that's fine, but we are claiming, as Philip Sidney is claiming, something much bigger than that. We are claiming that by imagining the world differently, we can learn a great deal from it. But that means that we must misrepresent the world. Let me speak a little bit more now about the notion of pleasure in Sir Philip Sidney. Sidney stresses the Horatian idea, the idea he gets from Horace, that poetry is not just useful, but also pleasurable. Philosophy and history might be useful, but let's be honest, they're not much fun. They're not pleasurable. There may be some people out there who are historians, there may be some people in this audience who are philosophers, and you probably know what I mean. When I say that, I mean, philosophy is fun, but it's a different kind of fun from putting your feet up with a good novel, a ripping good read, or a great poem. Philosophy is designed not to give you a bundle of laughs. Try reading Kant, and you'll see exactly what I mean. Not a joke to be... Well, there is one joke in Kant, and it's not a very funny one. Try reading Aristotle. Again, not a bundle of laughs in Aristotle. But that's... When I say a bundle of laughs, I mean a different kind of pleasure. Poetry is different from philosophy and different from history because it is designed, among many other things, to prioritise pleasure. Poetry improving on nature is already delightful because it improves on nature. But more than that, poetry effects a shift from what you might call epistemology to ontology. If you're not a philosopher, you would call that a shift from a prioritisation of knowing things to being things. It effects a shift in the language of Philip Sidney from gnosis to praxis. These form terms there. Gnosis, which means knowing things, to praxis, which means doing things. Okay? We're making a shift from knowing something to actually doing it. It's a wee bit like the difference between knowing that because you have a particular fortune, 10,000 a year, you're in want of a wife, and
meeting that wife and marrying her. There's between knowing something and living it. And poetry, argues Sir Philip Sidney, comes close to shifting you from the realm in which you know things to the realm in which you actually live them, so to speak. This is in some ways a kind of reversal of the Platonic and Aristotelian orientation, because it moves from knowledge to practice. They were interested in how you move from practice to knowledge. And there's a ground for this, however, in Plato's notion that life imitates art. If you take a little look again at the Sidney, if you look at the bit underneath, the bit I've just read, here is Sidney, and I've asked you to compare Shakespeare, Cornelius, Act 1, Scene 1. Infinite proofs of the strange effects of this poetical invention might be alleged. Only two shall serve, which are so often remembered I think all men know them. The one of Menenius Agrippa, who, when the whole people of Rome had resolutely divided themselves from the Senate, with apparent show of utter ruin, though he were for that time an excellent orator, came not among them upon trust of figurative speeches or cunning insinuations, and much less with far-fetched maxims of philosophy, which, especially if they were Platonic, they must have learned geometry before they could well conceived. But forsooth, he behaves himself like a homely and familiar poet. Okay, so the situation is one that you recognise from Coriolanus, Act 1, Scene 1. The people are in revolt. What do you do? Well, you don't go among them and say, according to the inexorable logic of my philosophy, you should not be in revolt because. You don't argue with them, and you don't give them a philosophical disquisition, because that's not going to... They're hungry. They want food. So what do? You go down like a poet instead. And when you do that, look at what happens. He telleth them a tale, says Sidney, that there was a time when all the parts of the body made a mutinous conspiracy against the belly, which they thought devoured the fruits of each other's labour. They concluded they would let so unprofitable a spender starve. In the end, to be short, for the tale's notorious, and as notorious that it was a tale, with punishing the belly, they plagued themselves. So the argument here is, we, the leaders, are the belly. We provide all the stuff that motivates the body. You're the head, hands and feet. You're the people that actually carry out the donkey work with your hands and with your feet. But you depend upon the belly for your existence. So if you're going to revolt against me, who am your belly, then by revolting against me and stabbing me and killing me, I'm afraid you're killing yourself. So what do? Well, A, you're seduced by the story because it makes beautiful sense. It's a lovely fable. And B, you don't stab me in the belly and you go back to work. And that's the point of it. So you move from the poetry to an action. You move from knowing something to actually doing something. Poetry makes something happen, is the argument here. Poetry can affect the way that people live. Remember from your LMW, W.B. Yeats asking himself exactly the same question. Did certain plays of mine lead to a position where those men get out there at Easter, at the Rising, and find themselves shot, or if not shot, later executed? Was that because of my art? He asks himself. Well, for Sidney, the answer is certainly possible that your art produced that kind of effect. Remember for W.H. Auden, in his great epitaph for W.B. Yeats, says completely the opposite. Poetry, he says, makes nothing happen, says Auden. However, the terms of the argument are set for us here in Sidney, who's learning this from Aristotle, who learnt it from Plato. Poetry, unlike philosophy, is teaching, as in this example, by the example itself, by rhetorical suasion, by telling a sweet story, a pleasurable story. Poetry doesn't work like philosophy by a process of ratiocination or rational argument. But poetry is all the more effective because it adds this delightful pleasure, this aesthetic pleasure that's involved in imitation. And the final passage that I want to read to you is from the final passage of the Apology here on the right hand side. For suppose it may be granted, that which I suppose if it may be denied, that the philosopher, in respect of his methodical proceeding, doth teach more perfectly than the poet. Yet do I think that no man is so much philosophos as to compare the philosopher in moving with the poet. Okay? Nobody is so
lover of thought, is what philosophers means. And that moving is of a higher degree than teaching, it may by this appear, that is well nigh the cause and the effect of teaching. So moving somebody, emotionally manipulating them, is what makes teaching possible. It's what I've been trying to do with you for about 15 weeks. I'm trying emotionally, sometimes with an anecdote, to get you into a position where you actually feel what it is that I'm trying to get across to you. And that's how all teaching works, says Sydney here. That moving is of a higher degree than teaching, it may by this appear, that it's well nigh the cause and the effect of teaching. For who will be taught if he be not moved with desire to be taught? And what so much good doth that teaching bring forth, I speak still of moral doctrine, as that it moveth one to do that which it doth teach. For, as Aristotle saith, it is not gnosis, but praxis must be the fruit. And how praxis cannot be without being moved to practice, it is no hard matter to consider. The philosopher showeth you the way, he informeth you of the particularities, as well as the tediousness of the way, as of the pleasant longing you shall have when your journey is ended, as of the many by-turnings that may divert you from your way. But this is to no man but to him that will read him, and read him with attentive studious painfulness, which constant desire whichever hath in him hath already passed half the hardness of the way, and therefore is beholding to the philosopher but for the other half. Nay, truly, learned men have learnedly thought that where one's reason hath so much overmastered passion as that the mind hath a free desire to do well, the inward light each mind hath in itself is as good as a philosopher's book, seeing in nature we know it is well to do well, and what is well and what is evil, although not in the words of art which philosophers bestow upon us. For out of natural conceit the philosophers drew it, but to be moved to that which we know, or to be moved with desire to know, hoc opus hic labor est. Thus the work is. Okay. And thus the labour is. In this, you're getting that position where you, as a critic, I think, have to ask yourself, what is the function of rhetoric in my criticism? All the way through these lectures, and all the way through your modes of reading classes, one of the things you've been trying to do is to find, from what position will you speak as a critic? From what position will you understand these texts? Do you want a kind of consistent philosophy that's going to be shaping and governing your literary criticism? If you are a feminist in your real life, are you a feminist in your literary life? Should you be? If you're a Marxist in your real life, are you a Marxist in your literary criticism? And vice versa. If you're a Marxist literary critic, should you become a Marxist in other aspects of your life as well? These are questions that have been getting posed for you for the last batch of weeks, among with a whole batch of other questions as well. But governing quite a lot of them is the fact that what you do is a lot of fun. What you do provides you with a great deal of pleasure. That's, you know, when I ask students when they come in the first year, why are you doing English? Most often there'll be a kind of lengthy pause as they think, that's a good question. Why the hell am I doing English? Didn't my mother or father ask me that only last week? Why are you doing English? You could be doing physics or law and making yourself a mint. Instead, you want to be a poet or something? God help us. So you ask yourself that, and then you come to the answer, well, actually, I enjoy reading. It gives me pleasure. And that's crucially important for what we do. But one of the things I've been trying to show you is that there is a social dimension to that pleasure. There's a politics of pleasure, in fact. Your pleasure might be causing somebody else pain. And sometimes, pain is not the opposite of pleasure. For the sadomasochists among you, you know that pain can be in itself the pain of struggling with Finnegan's Wake, the pain of struggling with a text that is extraordinarily difficult, nonetheless is a very sweet engagement that you make with literature. Aristotle and Sidney are deeply concerned with this, but not just for pleasure in its own sake. What they're concerned with is how pleasure actually shapes the world. And if you think about this, this is a very pragmatic way, a praxis-oriented way of thinking about literary criticism. Because one of the things concerned about is your practice and how poetry will shape that practice. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a man in possession of a fortune must be in want of a wife. It's one of the things that gets repeated to you, not just in Jane Austen, but in many, many texts. And because it gets repeated to you many times, and because it gets repeated to you in a way that makes you smile, makes you feel happy, you begin at some point to internalise that.
and that gives you a certain kind of knowledge. You as critics, however, don't stop there, you critique it. And in critiquing it, and in critiquing your own pleasure, you have to ask yourself, now, what is the function of this pleasurable criticism that I'm engaged in? The act of criticism, like the act of learning, reading at all, must in itself be something that produces the utile dulce. It must be useful, it must be pleasurable if it's going to work. There's no point in me writing a critical essay for you on, I don't know, Hand of Creation, if it's no fun to read. And by fun, I don't mean cheap fun. I mean something that actually rhetorically persuades you, moves you, changes you. And remember, if this is the last lecture I'm going to give here, the great words of Rilke, when Rilke faces a statue, the naked torso of Apollo. Take a look at the poem on the naked torso of Apollo, written by the great Swiss poet. The final line of which is, when you're confronted with this art, you ask yourself, what do you do? And the art tells you. And what it tells you is, you must change your life. That's what art's about. I'll stop on that today. I'll stop on that, as it were, for the series, unless you desperately want me to continue. Remember, I have a very high threshold of embarrassment, as you've seen over the last 14 weeks. So if you say, no, we've had enough, that's fine. I'm quite happy. Maybe rather than embarrass you by asking you, why don't you, through your SSLC, is the SSLC rep here? First year SSLC rep? Okay. Can you contact your SSLC rep and let her or him know whether you want these lectures to carry on or not? They'll then get a message to me and I'll come back either after the reading or I won't. Whatever happens, good luck with the rest of this course. You've been a very fine audience to speak with, and I've enjoyed working with you, and good luck with what comes up. Good luck. Thanks for your attention. No need to do it. Actually, that's being recorded. Do it again. Can you do it again? Do it more loudly. Good luck.